Welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon. We got a great episode here today. This is at Physician Contracts on Instagram. His name is Michael Johnson. He's an attorney that specializes in physician-based contracts. I'm a huge advocate for this. I think that this is something that's extremely important for all physicians so you don't get screwed by the man. You understand your contract, you understand how to leave that employment contract, and quite frankly, to be a happier physician overall. So please tune into this episode. I hope you enjoy it. You know, I'm 34 years old, making basically the same money that I did when I was 22 years old, working in the world of finance, you know, and I have different life goals. I'm trying to start maybe a family, you know, purchase a home. I got dogs to feed, cats to feed, all this stuff. It's extremely challenging. You know, so when I finish residency, I'm very financially motivated. You know, I don't have anything really in retirement of significance. I'm trying to make up for lost time. So I feel like so many physicians, newly graduating residents, are so focused on, okay, I want to make the most money possible. I want to make the highest, signing bonus, all these things possible. But one thing that I thought was very interesting that I saw in your Instagram handle was how the importance of an exit strategy and how that impacts basically your negotiation and the value of having that exit strategy. Because I forget the stat, but it's like most physicians leave their new job within 2 to 4 years after initially starting.
Yeah, so the first handful of employment world, okay, of years, there's tons of turnover in physician. I think this is a bit different than in times past, because for a lot of physicians that came out maybe in the 70s or 80s, a lot of them were independently operating. They weren't employed by large hospitals. That was really a thing. There wasn't like this large group practice, this mega health type situation. So they often hung their own shingle, started practicing, just a different setup. But now you end up, a lot of physicians end up working for large, like, mega employers. And it's just very difficult to get that first choice right. Like, there's so many moving parts. Not all jobs are the same. Even in psychiatry, like, the details about a specific job can vary quite wildly between call and what type of patients do you see and how much time do you have with each patient. And, you know, just do you have access to, like, just different methods of practicing, like how much autonomy and control that do you have? You know, what practice setting makes the most sense for you? It's very difficult to get that perfect with your first contract, right? So I encourage physicians to prioritize, especially on the front end, negotiating for the ability to leave that first job relatively comfortably, because I tell you, being stuck in that first job, without like the feeling that you can leave an unhappy situation can have a huge impact on your mental health as a physician, as a healthcare clinician. So one of the main things that we focus on with the law firm, the posts and information I produce on Instagram speaks to that practice is exactly that. And there's a ton of my,
Right. You know, and I would really argue that having a physician contract attorney can help avoid burnout. And we know that burnout is something that's so prevalent in the world of physicians, you know, even though all physicians, whether it's, you know, from pediatrics all the way up to neurosurgery, we are all compensated much, much higher than the average person here in America, right? Like, we're all doing well, extremely well. None of us are on food stamps by any means. That being said, how many physicians are unhappy with their current employment? It's, you know, I don't have the numbers Correct. In front of me, but it's a shit ton. It's a lot. And, you know, the physicians are at increased risk of suicide. Physicians are at increased risk of substance use. So I think a lot about how, like, involving a physician contract attorney can actually potentially mitigate against this. You know, like, I almost view you as, like, in a sense, like a divorce attorney, like getting a prenup agreement before you enter into this contract, because then you at least feel emboldened, entitled to, okay, well, I know exactly what this entails if I want to leave and find a new gig.
They have this mentality, this experience that you... Exactly. So a good physician contract lawyer is going to help you understand what these terms mean for being able to leave. A lot of physicians. You go to residency and you're there for 4 years. You go to fellowship, you're there for 1 or 2 or 3 years. Or, you know, you go to medical school and you're there for 4 years. Like, you're long periods, like, kind of no matter what, right? So we're kind of conditioned, and using that in like a pejorative way, conditioned to right. be committed for a big piece of the transition from training to your post-training, your attending life. You no longer have like that light at the end of the tunnel, that kind of endpoint, right? You have that, for me, is trying to pull you out of that mindset, okay? I need you to think about this next chapter of your career and your life very differently. You tunnel. Let's say you're unhappy in residency, you know, you're a couple years out, like that can be extremely challenging, but at least at a minimum, you have light at the end of the tunnel. But when you sign up for your first attending job, if you don't like it and you feel trapped by something in your employment contract, maybe you don't even understand, maybe you're not even trapped in your employment contract, but you just don't understand your options. You're just afraid to ask. You have maybe some anxiety about just knowing the good, bad, or the ugly about your contract. And then all of a sudden now you have a 30 or 40 year light. That's not a very bright light, right? So you really right. can't power through a situation that is unhappy once you're out of training. Like, if you're in a 1 year fellowship and, you know, you're really getting pinched very hard, you're really, you know, you're on Q2 call and it's overnight call every single night for 182 nights a year, some total nonsense. You're like, right. okay, I got to do this for 1 year and I can move on. But your first attending job, you know, you're looking at that, oh, this is a 30 or 40 year horizon. I can't deal with that. Some physicians will look at that. They'll realize, okay, I'm unhappy in the practice of medicine, so I need to get out of medicine. I want to do FIRE, financial independence, retire early. I want to pick up side gigs. I want to leave the clinical practice of medicine. I would kind of want to push back on that a little bit. Like, we really need physicians to be able to seek out happy situations, to be able to practice, be able to see patients and treat patients. So part of what I see my role as a physician contract lawyer is to help you even that playing field, frankly, help some of your employers save themselves from themselves, if you will, to be able to retain you, be able to keep you practicing medicine in a way that's happy for an extended period.
Right. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, touching upon that oncologist that I shouted out earlier, Dr. Alan Brady, I don't know how old that fool was, but let's just call it 70 something. I mean, and he was still skiing. He was still happy. He was still teaching. And so I actually get incredibly sad when I have friends like this who are extremely motivated for FIRE. And for the listeners, it's financial independence, retire early. And they want to make, you know, just retire as early as they can. Really makes me so sad because, you know, this journey to becoming a physician is anything but short. You know, it's a marathon. We went through at least 4 years of undergraduate. I had to do extra years for my pre-med years, 4 years of medical education, and then my program is 4 years of residency. Some of my colleagues who are surgeons do 5, if not more than that. It's crazy. Yet I have friends who routinely talk about how they want to be retired by the age of 45. So I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I want to do everything possible to try to motivate these individuals to maybe take on a different balance, right? And maybe one thing I really like that you talk a lot about, how if we want to qualify for PSLF, Public Service Loan Forgiveness, you don't technically have to work full time. You can take a 0.8 schedule, right? You know, maybe working 30 something hours a week allows you to, you know, catch the mountains on your free time, spend more time with your family, because I am so passionate about trying to promote longevity instead of trying to murder yourself to earn as much money as possible.
I agree. So some of the, I guess, most common, I guess I call pretty much everything a physician contract, the mental health clause in the contract. It all affects your work-life balance, your happiness, your connection to your career and your profession, right? But a couple of the things that really stand out to me is negotiating work schedule and negotiating just the scope of your work obligations. For us, my wife is a psychiatrist. I don't know if we mentioned that earlier, but I kind of came at it from, you know, I started dating my wife right before the week before match. And then after match, luckily she matched in New Orleans. So we got to stay together. That was nice. Really cool.
You bought in at the right time, Michael.
I did buy in at the right time. So we went all through residency together, and you know, during residency, like every month is a little bit different. Every rotation is a little bit different, right? Your schedule is kind of just determined by somebody else. And after 4 years of that, we looked at each other. We had, you know, a 6-month-old in the house, and I had started a small law firm helping physicians. But we looked at it like, you know what? We really want to control our work schedule, how much time the employer can really take from us, and for how much you're willing to be paid to give up that time. So we prioritized employers that were willing to negotiate on work schedule. Allie works a 3-12 schedule with 7.5 weeks of PTO. And you start doing that math, that's 135 days. Look, 12 hours of psychiatry, that'd be a lot. Okay, I couldn't do that. That fits for her, for her schedule and for her life and what she wants to do. But working out like a work obligations limitation that was like that allows us 230 days a year where she doesn't have to work. She can explore some moonlighting gigs if she wants to. We can go on plenty of vacations. We went to went out of the country for a month during a little bit of a sabbatical. We regularly have 10 days straight with time off. We just prioritize employers that offered that. Another way to accomplish that is through a reduced schedule. A lot of first contract physicians, all they know is you go work full time, you do whatever they tell you, and they pay you a bunch of money, and like, I don't know anything after that, right? But you have other options. So a 0.8 FTE means that you're working an 80% schedule of whatever the full time is. So let's say you're working a job where the full time schedule is, we'll do easy math because I'm on the fly here. Okay, I'm not great on math on the fly. But let's say your 1.0 is $400,000 a year. That's a base salary. So you could work a 0.8 FTE, and maybe now you work Monday through Thursday, all of your Fridays are off. And then maybe you now, instead of 400, you make 320. 320 is still a lot of money. You can still make a big impact on your personal finances and your life doing that way. And then now imagine you're also, you know, you also have over $400,000 in student loans. That's pretty common right now. That was our situation. We also have my private, my student loans from private law school. Private law school wasn't the best financial decision I ever made. But a cornerstone of our financial future is PSLF. And you get the same amount of public service loan forgiveness if you work a 1.0 job, or if you work at least 30 hours per week and the employer still considers whatever that amount is to be full time. Like, that's a limit for your time to be qualifying under PSLF. So I encourage a lot of first contract physicians that maybe one of their primary factors of picking their first job is whether that job qualifies for public service loan forgiveness. Seriously consider prioritizing the minimum that is required to qualify in your first contract. A lot of employers will not be too keen on, may even deny your request to reduce your workload in the future. But since they're trying to like woo you and get you there, they might give it to you on the front end. And then they're always going to let you work more. Okay. They would let you work 2 times, 3 times what everybody else says, do you want to do? Like, they're always going to let you expand your work obligation in the future. I've run across very, very few that will say like, no, you can't work any more than what we're offering. But if you want to expand, like if a 0.8 FTE of 30 hours, let's say for a psychiatrist, that might be 30 patient contact hours and a few admin hours, and you can do those 30 hours now, maybe relatively comfortably in 3 days, maybe spread it out to 4 days. And now you have 3-day weekends every week, and you have 7 weeks off of PTO every year. Now that's something that is very maintainable for an appropriate salary. So just one of the steps you can take to protect your mental health when you're transitioning from training to post-training life.
Did you know Dr. Logan Noon has another podcast that he's hosting? That's right. The Zeitgeist Podcast, where I'm the co-host. I'm Dr. Jun Chun. We talk about educational material regarding everything mental health. So if you like this content, make sure you give the Zeitgeist Podcast a listen as well.
Yeah, check it out. It's on all major platforms. Very easy to find. Just called The Zeitgeist. Provide therapy on my own schedule, maybe do kind of the weird, crazy stuff of psychiatry that's coming out right now, you know, ketamine, psychedelics, transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy, all this new wild, fun stuff. But I, you know, the old school jobs, I feel like, aren't always on the keen edge, the cutting edge of innovative solutions. So it's, I think, very likely that I will sign a contract with some large healthcare employer, whether that's, you know, the VA I'm considering, something local, who knows? I don't want to disclose, you know, of course, too many details. Before we got on the recording here, you know, you were talking a lot about this philosophy of, like, you know, when you work for one of these large institutions, you can't feel, like, personally attacked from them. Like, they're out to get you. They're against your personal best interest. And how, look, these big, large entities have their own interest at heart. You know, normally it's profit motivated. But how do you talk to your clients about this?
Yeah, so I got an email about 20 minutes before we started this podcast. It got me really hot. I felt like I've calmed down since then. This is my calm level. Mm-hmm. But it was an email from a mid-level hospital administrator, okay? Just on the surface, okay? Folks who work in hospital administration are often only qualified, only authorized to tell you no to whatever you're asking for, okay? They put you in the situation where you have to communicate with someone internally, like there's usually 3 or 4 or 5 different layers between you and the C-suite. And that initial layer that you talk to in large employers are often only authorized to tell you no. They're only authorized to, like, do or tell you whatever they're told from above. Like, it's just, it doesn't really work great. But these very, like, hierarchical organizations can make individual physicians that are kind of operating in this scenario, they're operating on the bottom of a long, long chain of management. They're very far away from managerial decision-making, okay? They can make you feel just frankly very small. They can use language that can be very frustrating. I like to call it gaslighting sometimes because I realize that's a very aggressive word, but I think it applies to a lot of the conversations that large employers end up having with their physicians. Like, here's an example. When a physician, I had a physician ask for a reasonable termination without cause clause, where they could leave the first contract within 90 to 180 days notice. And the employer said no, it's a 3-year contract, 3 years no out. And we need that because of continuity of care and all of the investments that we make in recruiting you. And they act like that's just okay. Like, mm-hmm. You know what's great, better for continuity of care? Actually empowering the physicians to make clinical decisions that make sense for their patients, actually empowering physicians to, like, decide how their job works, out listening to them on how the job should be organized. You know what physicians, like, won't leave is a job where they feel heard and listened to and they have autonomy and control over the practice. Like, you want to reduce turnover. Basically, they're telling you they need a 3-year no-out contract because they have way too much turnover and it's destroying their business. But that's not really your fault, right? The way that they fix that isn't creating more terrible contracts. It's changing how they approach their relationship with physicians. So just an example, I like to help physicians, particularly first contract physicians, maybe identify some of these gaslighting-like statements that come from particularly larger employers and understand it for what it is. Okay, it's not about you. It's not, like, unique to you in many situations. This is something, frankly, my spouse, my wife struggle with a little bit. And I'd also encourage physicians who are maybe feeling a little bit frustrated with their job situation. Maybe they constantly hear these kind of negative, you know, basically you don't matter, like your feelings aren't heard, like we just need you to do more and do it exactly what they say. You just hear this all the time. If you're feeling, you know, down and upset, like frustrated with that, I would encourage you to consider counseling. I'd also encourage you to negotiate your contract so it's easier to leave a job that makes you feel that way. But at its core, you might find out through this process that it's really just not about you. A lot of these larger healthcare organizations, they're just not set up to be friendly to physicians. They often see physicians as an input, the same way as like capital is an input. You know, equipment and supplies are an input. Sometimes they see physicians as the workforce and not as Dr. Logan. Right.
Right.
So it's often not about you. It's usually about them. Unfortunately, in my practice, you know, I haven't seen it like changing for the better yet. Mm. So it's important to keep that in mind. But yeah, being able to protect your ability to leave and, you know, maybe having a little bit of understanding, a little insight that whatever they're telling you, it's not about you, it's about them.
Right, right. And, you know, we talked about even before recording, like the importance of finding a good therapist, somebody you feel, you know, open and willing to talk about. And, you know, as physicians, we're in a high stress environment. We're more prone to, you know, depression, substance abuse, suicide, like I said earlier. So I couldn't be more passionate and agree with you about, you know, finding a good therapist. So I'm curious from your perspective as an attorney, you know, are you ever able to write that into a contract? What I mean by that is I want every Wednesday off from 1 to 2 where I can meet with my therapist, or rather I want you paying for it. I don't want to pay for it. You know, is that something that you can build into a contract?
I suppose you can. So the work schedule is something that I love to negotiate for. You know, typically a physician contract will say work obligations shall be determined in the discretion of the employer based on clinical need. Mm. Like what does that mean?
I don't like the sound of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds terrible, right? So very standard though. Sometimes the like compensation and obligation section of a contract could be 2 lines. Mm. You have a base salary of $400,000 and your schedule shall be determined at sole discretion of the employer. I read one the other day like that. It's like, what am I supposed to do with that? I like the idea of building in some very specific protections around your time. You know, if you want a Wednesday afternoon off, if you want, instead of 10 blocks, sometimes physician contracts, they think of your time as like block, particularly like ambulatory, like clinic-based type practices. I'm thinking about psychiatry. Let's say 10 blocks, Monday afternoon, Monday evening, all your weekday, morning and evening, 10 blocks. So if you want, you can probably negotiate for 1 or 2 of those off, or one or two of those being assigned to being admin time, or maybe being flexible to do something else. It's something that we very much prioritize. I don't know that I've asked specifically for a particular time off in the middle of the day for that reason, but I have negotiated for specific admin blocks that you know, basically getting in an email exchange on the front end. Hey, look, your admin time, you know, we're going to block off an hour and a half in the middle of the day. Part of it is lunch, but it's also, you know, your admin time. Little caveat to that, though. If you have admin time that is structured in the middle of your day, often the employer will think of that time as like an emergency slot. Let's say you didn't fill one of the hours earlier on, okay?
Right.
Your 10 o'clock cancel, you had an initial eval at 10 o'clock, your psychiatrist had an initial eval at 10 o'clock, and they canceled. So all of a sudden you had 10 to 11 off, but you have admin time from 12 to 2. Now a lot of employers will say, you know what, you already kind of had your hour off, so could you just like see this emergent patient? And oh, by the way, we need something else from 12 to 12:30. And oh, by the way, like, can you just answer these 2 phone calls real quick during your lunch? And it's like, where did my admin time go? I negotiated for something right. That's not very important, right? So I actually like to at least consider the idea of negotiating out of admin time, just negotiating like, here are the hours that I'm required to provide direct patient contact. Okay, again, thinking primarily about outpatient clinic practices now, but saying all the rest is my obligation, okay, my responsibility. I have to submit my notes on time. I have 24, 48 hours, 30 or 72 hours, whatever's written into the contract, to submit all my notes on time. But when I take my admin time is up to me, but these are the only times that you can schedule me for patients. So actually go the opposite direction for that issue.
Interesting. So, you know, another thing, you know, I've asked you even publicly on your Instagram handle, and you've done some really good, you know, Instagram lives or reels, whatever they call it now, about residency stipend agreements. And, you know, this is something I feel pretty passionate about because I think the world of being a resident and the financial structure of it is so utterly stupid. You know, I don't understand why we're paid such a low salary. And then on the other side, once I do reach attendinghood, my salary goes, you know, 4 to 6x, whatever. It's ridiculous. It's like, why isn't this more a linear structure instead of this exponential curve that, you know, look, unless you come from, quite frankly, a wealthy background, you know, it's tough living off a very a resident salary. So, you know, it's also kind of weird. So I'm in residency here in Philadelphia. Fun fact, 1 in 6 residents that have trained in the United States were actually trained in the greater Philadelphia region. There's a lot of residencies in this area, yeah. A lot of medical schools, you know, New York's not that far away, DC, Baltimore, the whole thing. Whereas I went to medical school, Pacific Northwest University out in good old Yakima, Washington, middle of nowhere, Washington, in a sense, where these kind of residency stipend agreements were much more prevalent, you know, maybe because it's more a rural area, maybe there's less percentage of physicians. And just so the audience is better informed what I'm talking about, residency stipend agreement would be you would get like a monthly stipend to agree to future employment, you know, whether that be $1,000, $2,000 a month up until when you graduate residency, and then you have to you know, promise X amount of time to that employer. How do you advise residents to, you know, consider these contracts? Because they sound really good on the surface. Like, are there things I'm missing, not thinking about? What are your 2 cents?
Yeah, so fellowship stipends, residency stipends, any employer that is paying you like quite a bit in advance before you get there, there's a reason that they're doing that, okay? You're incredibly valuable as a physician. You're one of the scarcest resources that we have and the most valuable like subsector economy that we have, okay? They really, really need you. There's very few of you and there's a huge need for your services. So a lot of employers, particularly employers in relatively unattractive regions or, you know, that serve maybe a certain population that is less attractive for physicians to serve, it really just depends, okay? But just basic like economics consider, you know, cause them to consider starting to pay physicians in advance. And some of these contracts can be quite substantial. Even for like a psychiatrist, I've seen some where they'll pay you a signing bonus of $50,000 and a training stipend of $2,000 per month for every month up to like 2 years. Okay. So now we're looking at 50 plus 48. Sometimes they'll even add on like some other sexy stuff, like a moving stipend where they pay you $25,000 to cover your moving expenses. They might pay you a student loan stipend or some other just one-off sweetener. I like to lump all these together as like the one-off sweeteners. Okay. Those aren't free money. You're not in the NFL. You didn't get drafted by the Giants. Like that's not what we're dealing with. That is an advance on work that you haven't performed yet. So let's say in our hypothetical, you have a signing bonus of $50,000 and, you know, $2,000 a month for 2 years. So that's $48,000, $98,000. We'll round it out to $100,000. There's usually some sort of time commitment that you're required to continue working for that employer to actually earn that $100,000. And if you don't work that extended period, then you have to pay back all or some of that money. That's a very important negotiation point. How much? How long? Is it a 5-year commitment, 3-year commitment, 2-year commitment? What if you serve half of that time? Do you have to pay back half of it or do you have to pay back 100% of it? What if the employer terminates you without cause? What if you leave without cause? Most contracts will allow the employer to claw that money back from you. It's a compensation clawback issue. That's usually how I term it when I'm talking about it with physicians. They can claw that money back regardless of the reason the contract ends. If it ends for any reason before whatever the stated term is, they get to take that money back. It can be really hard for physicians, particularly early contract physicians, to buy their freedom from that first contract. Like, imagine you got to come out of pocket for $100,000 because, like, you've been working at this job for 6 months and you're miserable. It's terrible. They, you know, really sold you you know, a bag, and it's just not what you expected. So now that $100,000 probably be taxed at about a 45% to 50% rate. Okay, you're about to jump into a much, much more punitive tax bracket. Okay, right. You have to really consider taxes when you're in residency. Your taxes, your marginal tax rate is relatively low. That's right. Going to go away very, very quickly. So now, out of the $100,000, you actually have about, you know, 50 to 55. If you're in California, it's going to be even lower because there's state taxes. Okay, so you probably use that money to move, maybe to, like, you know, get out of, like, your beater car, like something that you actually drive around now. Like, you might have paid off, like, some credit cards or something that's, like, very, you know, like an immediate need, right? And you're not going to have that money to buy your freedom. So you get trapped into a situation where you literally can't say no. You can't push back against the employer. You can't leave because you don't have the money to buy your freedom from that contract. If you sign on to those agreements and your compensation plan does not have some sort of automatic increase in it, mm-hmm. you might end up losing more than $100,000 because now you've lost your ability to renegotiate compensation. It's really hard to negotiate for more compensation under the threat of exit when you have to pay your employer $100,000 to be able to leave a contract, right? Like, how are you going to do that? Imagine you're in psychiatry. Psychiatry of the last 3 years has averaged about 12% increase in compensation year over year. That can't last forever, okay? You can't outpace inflation that long, okay? Like, eventually it'll start to, like, the curve will start to, you know, mm-hmm. shorten a little bit. But it's not a stretch to say that a psychiatrist that's making $300K in 2020 really should be making $400K in 2028, 2029, 2030. Now, imagine you signed a flat salary model contract 2 years before you were supposed to start, and it was a five-year contract with a $100,000 clawback period. Now, you've agreed to a set salary for 7 years. In psychiatry, that's going to cost you a ton of money. 12% a year is supposed to go up, and now it's flat for 7 years. So now when you got your $100,000, you probably actually gave up more than $100,000 over the next 5 years because you've reduced your negotiation leverage. Another issue, at that moment in training, in fact, I want you to, before you sign your first contract, at least have enough experiences in residency to know or have a pretty good idea of what you want. Okay, let's say you want outpatient, but you realize, I don't really like outpatient. I haven't really done a lot of outpatient, but now I've done, like, usually the last 2 years for psychiatry is primarily outpatient. Right. I don't know if your experience was a little bit different, but exactly. I think that's pretty much the norm, right? So, like, let's imagine you go for the first 2 years, you did medicine, you did neuro, and then, like, you did primarily inpatient. Maybe you did some other stuff, but you're like, man, I really want inpatient. Like, that's what I've been doing. It's great. But then you sign a contract, and then now you did a handful of rotations outpatient, and you're like, man, that's what I want to do. But now you've signed a contract, you've accepted $50,000 plus $2,000 a month. You've already kind of committed to this deal. So now you have, like, a 7-year window to maybe be able to buy, like, get out of that deal that was wrong. So I saw this recently with a family practice doc that was offered something like this within the first, like, 3 or 4 months of training. Oh, wow. I was like, whoa, that's pretty wild. But I would encourage you to, one, if you're going to sign something with that big of an initial payment and that much of a fellowship type and signing bonus, like, stop. Make sure you get with a lawyer that really knows what they're doing. Okay, this can be very, very painful to get out of. You can potentially cause a big problem. Okay, that's not a time to kind of wing it. Second, consider whether you have enough information from your training to make an informed choice about what you want to do with your career. Err on the side of, like, less. Okay, if you have any doubts, like, hey, I'm not far enough through to know kind of what I want to do, I would err on the side of waiting. Now, on the flip side, I also encourage physicians to consider looking for jobs like 9, 12, 15 months out. Okay. because the earlier that you can start, the more likely it is that you can say no to a potential employer that has a poor contract, or you can kind of, you know, have a few more experiences trying to find the right connection. But also there's some risks in starting too early, particularly if you pick that job because of a massive like initial payment. Now, the mental health benefits of getting a contract evaluation by a lawyer that really knows what they're doing at that moment, those are, you've got to get a check of $50,000. Oh, by the way, it really help you just clarify what are the pros and cons to that job, to that deal. You know what the pros are going to be taxed, right? But you're going to see the way it's about to be reduced to about 27, right. 28, 29 grand by the time it gets to you, because it's probably, but there's strings attached. A good lawyer that knows what they're doing in this area will help you like clear that number, and you're going to be like, you know what, that's like 6 months of my salary. I'm wild not to take this. But those compensation clawback clauses to an external metric that automatically goes up, over verify your thoughts, make sure you understand the pros and cons of what you're signing, potentially negotiate some of the details around, maybe negotiate for a compensation package that is tied to what looks to be a long contract with a massive initial payment with a long clawback provision. Under time, that kind of matches the market, that sort of thing. You know, negotiating on compensation might be very important if you're signing.
Right, right. You know, it is, I can't tell you how tempting it is. You know, what would an extra anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 a month right now, you know, as a 30-year resident mean for my life? You know, it really would change a lot of things. So I feel like I go back and forth on this thing all the time because, you know, there's a philosophy one of my great friends has kind of instilled into my mind. It's, you know, do I live to work or do I work to live? You know, and it's, I kind of like the latter, work to live, you know, it's, I had this discussion with my program director, like, as much as I love psychiatry, it can't be the most important thing to me in the world. You know, my personal life, my relationship with my wife, my family, my two dogs, you know, so all that being said, all the negatives, all the strings attached, you know, it's definitely something I'm still considering, you know, so if you're listening, and you're considering maybe a contract like this, you know, I think do your homework and hire somebody who's, you know, an expert in this space like you are, Michael. So, you know, look, I wish residency stipend agreements were something that didn't even exist, because this is ridiculous. You know, like this exponential curve of salary growth is what I think breeds a lot of burnout, stress, you know, all this stuff. So I'm very curious from your perspective, who is so knowledgeable about the, you know, employment in this healthcare system. You know, I'm a big proponent of unions. You know, there is such thing as like CRR, which is a very large residency union. To my knowledge, maybe there's small instances of like physician unions, but I don't really know a ton of them. Do you think a physician union is realistic in the future? Do you think that this is something that could actually form, that could benefit not only just physicians, but also patients? Because if we have happier physicians, you know, hopefully we'll have better patient outcomes and, you know, better healthcare as a whole. What is your opinion?
Yeah, so this is an issue that I think about quite often. And I'm curious one day when we come back to this podcast, like 5 or 10 years from now, whether I'm going to be red-faced about my answer or not. I don't know. I might change my opinion on this. There's a number of moving parts that might happen over the next 5 or 10 years. For now, I think that we are better off with individual physicians negotiating their contract, maybe having some macro level data, negotiating the details of the contract, kind of like a whole, like all physicians really need to negotiate that first contract and negotiate every other deal thereafter. I think that healthcare employers get emboldened when physicians sign deals that are just objectively bad. We need more penalties for employers that offer bad deals. We need physicians making better deals, and that's just one of my goals with the law firm, with the practice, with the Instagram. I've had this joke with in-house general counsels for healthcare companies. I tell them, look, you got to negotiate with me, okay? You have to create fair contracts, because if you don't, the next step is a physician union, okay? Right. And if we can't make any inroads – Okay, if you continue to shove like terrible contracts down physicians' throats, if you continue to merge with each other, create just these massive conglomerates, then the next step is physician unions. It really should be antitrust, like the FTC and just antitrust right. litigation need to break up some of these healthcare companies that really consolidate entire markets. Just on the macro level, just digress for a moment, okay? A lot of healthcare employers are merging with each other. The surface level argument for that is to increase their negotiation leverage against payors, against insurance companies, negotiate better rates, that sort of thing. But one of the other 80s, the vast majority of physicians practice independently. They were not directly employed by hospitals. They were not employed in these law motivations. Or maybe just one of the other outcomes is that they have much more leverage against individual physicians. Remember, back in like the large practice settings, now the vast majority of physicians are employed directly by hospitals or in these mega groups like multi-specialty practices. There's a little bit of nuance based on your specialty and what you're trying to accomplish, okay, painting with some broad brushes. But now that the market is so much more, I guess, consolidated, it's becoming more difficult for an individual physician to say, hey, look, I can get a better deal down the road across the street, you know, one town over, because guess what? That large healthcare company now owns that other practice that you would normally go to potentially get a better deal. And, you know, there's a lot of markets where the major player is buying out the most successful local private practices, or those private practices are being purchased in whole or in part by private equity. So there's, again, a consolidation in healthcare that does make it more difficult to negotiate for physicians to negotiate. It's not all doom and gloom. You can get tons of important changes into your contracts, okay? I don't think we're there yet. But I think if the pendulum continues to swing in that direction and they go a little bit too far, then physician unions might be the next step. There's some legal hurdles, okay? Like, it's tough to unionize if you're like more in like a managerial capacity. You supervise and control others. So, you know, that kind of brings in the NP/NPA scope of practice issue. I don't know if we need to dive into that as deeply, but like physicians supervising, managing others could potentially be a legal hurdle to unionizing. That is not an area that I focused on in my legal practice. So I'd be really interested if you brought on a like union specific, someone who's worked with, you know, unions to have a conversation about that. Cause I'm very interested how that's going to work out. Right. But we'll see.
Unless my employer gets wind of it.
I have. So with my Instagram presence, I end up connecting with a lot of folks that, you know, have done some social media outreach, maybe have done some organizing, maybe have organized residency unions at their residency. My experience thus far is that there has not been any like negative backlash from being like one of the residents that organized at your residency. So if you're considering getting involved with organizing in your residency, again, limited experience with my practice. I primarily represent physicians looking at their first job. I'm not seeing a penalty, like a negative impact. Okay. I encourage you to do that. I think that's the best path for residency, but I'm not quite sold yet that it's the best path for physicians. I'd rather more competition, less consolidation, and just physicians learning how to advocate for themselves, maybe fighting a little bit harder on negotiating their contracts, maybe a little bit more education on the front end during residency and fellowship. That's another thing that we could probably have a whole podcast about, is, you know, certain gaps in your education and in training and why those gaps exist. I have my ideas, but you know, you can kind of fill in the dots.
Well, I really like that answer, because, you know, if we're eventually going to live in like a, you know, Bernie Sanders environment with a single payer system, I think like a physician union is absolutely imperative. You know, I don't know how that system would operate, you know, very analogous to like a police union, a firefighter union, teacher union, something like that. But, you know, look, we don't live in Bernie Sanders healthcare environment. You know, this is, it's still, you know, say what you want about it, but it, the way it's structured, there's many different companies. So maybe actually the best approach is, like you're saying, is antitrust law and breaking apart some of these huge conglomerates that, you know, I don't have a ton of faith in the judiciary system to really act upon that antitrust, but hopefully the future will be bright. You know, it is unfortunate because I talk to, you know, as a resident, I have a lot of attending psychiatrists managing me, right? They have to sign all my notes and they help teach me and they're kind of doom and gloom, if I'm being honest. You know, they talk about, in a sense, kind of the glory days of medicine and how they don't like what's moving forward. And I hope that, you know, what I do on my podcast, I hope what you do on, you know, your social media presence can help change some of that. Because I hope over this, you know, geez, we've been talking for 50 minutes, I've convinced you, you listeners out there, to, if you are a physician, or I imagine also like an NP or PA or even nurse, to consider hiring some kind of contract attorney so that, you know, I do think it has so many mental health benefits that, it's not always just about the salary. You know, I feel like so many individuals are just focused on more money, more money, more money, and that's going to bring me more happiness. When, you know, that famous study from years ago, it's what, past like 75K doesn't really bring more happiness.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, right. You know, I imagine with inflation, it's higher than that, but whatever, you know, every single physician, even the lowest paid, is going to be making significantly more than that. So this issue of being happy as a physician is so much more than being compensated the most money possible. You know, I hope that we did some education and you know, for my colleagues who are really motivated for FIRE, I hope you can contribute to healthcare in other ways if you do want to retire early. But, you know, really, we have such a valuable skill set and we can be such benefit to our communities that I hope we are still willing to engage with healthcare in some capacity for, in a sense, maybe our entire life. So I know. Go ahead, Michael.
One comment on the FIRE folks. Slight caveat to that. I firmly believe that physicians that are in a very healthy financial situation, like their personal finances are in order, mm-hmm. are able to push back against the negative aspects of healthcare employment better, frankly, mm-hmm. than physicians that don't have that financial cushion. If you're in a position where you can leave a job, you can change, you're not tied like financially to the employer, you're not living paycheck to paycheck. It's really hard to get out of that during residency and fellowship. Okay, you just don't make enough to save enough to have an emergency fund to start building for retirement to mm-hmm. have like the ability to walk away. Okay. But if you spend the first couple years of your career building up a significant personal financial buffer that allows you control and autonomy over your decisions, that can help patients. That can make you a better clinician because you have more freedom to tell your employer no and practice the way that you deem is best for your patients. You have more freedom to change jobs, potentially start your own practice, you know, start a different type of practice. I think that physicians who prioritize their personal finances early on in the career, whether it's pursuing PSLF or saving for retirement or, you know, whatever it is, I think that's super helpful for us. The physicians that come to me 5 or 10 years into their career and have a cushion and can easily say no and can easily walk away from a job that they don't like, give me a lot more leverage to ask for more. I mean, typically get more. The more that we can ask, typically the more that we can get. So I encourage you to consider, like, the financial piece as part of your future contract renegotiation leverage.
What resources would you provide or point in the right direction for, you know, individuals like me? Like White Coat Investor is one that I always use and talk about. What resources would you suggest?
So White Coat Investor, I really like the content. And for White Coat Investor, it's very target, okay? They encourage you to continue living like a resident for 2 to 5 years, not forever. For 2 to 5 years, get your personal finances in order, pay down some student loans, build up a retirement starting point, and then ease into your new salary. Okay, that is great advice. I like the physician for 80% of the results. Dr. Jimmy Turney also has another book, Determined, Philosopher's Guide to Personal Finance. It basically says, you know, here is the 20% that you need to know to accomplish 80%. and it really great, like, intro to personal finance. He's about to publish an update to that book. There are tons of changes that are coming to student loans that you need to be aware of. We can't even really talk about them because they're still kind of in flux. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there's some resources out for that. I really like my favorite book for negotiation is Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference. It's like an oldie but a goodie.
Okay.
If you ever have a chance to just listen to it for like an hour. And if you don't like it, just say, Michael, you're a knucklehead. Like, it's not very good. But just give it a try. It's a lot of fun. I love it as someone who negotiates literally all day as my job. I really love that.
What kind of arguments do you and your wife must have? But one attorney, one psychiatrist, it must be like a sitcom here. This must be insane.
How am I supposed to do that?
Right,
one of my favorite lines. What does that mean? What questions kind of over and over again can be an incredibly like helpful way to negotiate. Typically, you know, you get out of some of the knee jerk, like emotional responses to questions, and you can start requiring your negotiation opponent to like resolve your problem. Sometimes when I'm negotiating against another attorney, I just say, look, here's my client's problem. Here's what they really need to move forward with this job. How can you help me resolve this problem? You fix this problem for me. Here's the problem. My client can't do X. They won't do Y. How can we fix this? And I keep just asking like what and how questions. I don't know if my negotiation opponents actually listen to the end of this podcast. I hope a lot of people listen to the end of this podcast, but not them.
Right.
But that is like a typical negotiation strategy for me. Like, how am I supposed to do that? What does that mean? Asking your opponent to resolve your problem can be an incredibly effective way to negotiate. Chris Voss like breaks that down quite a bit and does a great job with it. Just resources to like get you from training, like through post-training into your attending life. I hope that's also me. I hope that's the Instagram presence. I'm hoping that I continue creating some content there to kind of help you navigate that soon. Allie and I are going to publish kind of a more extensive like discussion about our process of the last 4 or 5 years. Hopefully that will be helpful to folks. Those are some of the main pieces that I listen to.
I know you're very successful on Instagram. Do you post on other platforms or a blog in any kind or add position contracts as your main go-to?
So the Instagram is my main platform. I have a website at physiciancontracts.com. Big surprise, right? I have some other presences, but they're not building up on LinkedIn, but that has been the main as active. And frankly, I just get too busy. Like, I should be better about like creating a TikTok or YouTube or, I don't know, 35 and 40 is who I guess location to connect with a lot of residents and fellows, folks between end up representing the most. And that's usually where they're at. So,
and are you only practicing with physicians in Wisconsin? Do you cover other states?
We handle employment contract matters across the country for all specialties. Now, if you're getting specifically into like small business ownership, or maybe you're getting out of the different, you're co-owning a small business, then you might need to do the more, I guess, traditional physician contracting realm. You're doing something different, okay? But we are in Wisconsin, Louisiana, Texas, Maryland, New Jersey, New York. We're adding a couple more here soon. So we can do physician employment contracts across the country. Stepping outside of that, we're a little bit more limited. I also do, like, it's my primary practice area at this point. It's about 90% of what I do. But I also do some litigation. I'll litigate on behalf of physicians. I'll litigate on behalf of small business owners, small business general counsel. I'll do a little bit of that as well. But representing physicians is my central passion.
Well, cool, cool. It's nice that you have that diversity in your practice. And yeah, I didn't really realize that you work with clients really all over the country. So, you know, we do have a great presence of this audience across the country. So if you are listening and you are interested in having Michael as your contract attorney, physician contracts, or, you know, I imagine through that Instagram page is the easiest way to find you. Yeah. And I'll make sure to put all your contact info in the description. You know, Michael, we've been talking for an hour. I could chat your ear off for another 4 hours here, but I'll have you on again on the other podcast that I host called The Psych Guys. Thank you so much for your time. This has been super fun, super educational. Is there anything else you would like to share before we call it a day here?
No, that's really it. I really would love for first contract physicians to fully evaluate and seriously consider negotiating that first contract. The more that first contract physicians do that, the more we like continue to normalize this process, the easier it is for the next person to do it and the next one. And it just kind of builds on itself. It's really not about winning changes to your contracts. It's not a scoreboard. Okay.
Right.
It's about kind of capturing your value as a physician and negotiating for what's most important to you, helping the profession maybe gain some leverage against some of the other actors in the healthcare arena. So I really encourage you to consider evaluating and negotiating your contracts. One last thing, in our house, we recently got your book, We All Have Something, your children's book. So it's become my son. My son's 4 years old, 4 years old. He's a little bit younger, I think, than the target audience, but he really loves it. We've read it for 2 evenings in a row. We're probably going for number 3 this evening. It was really nice. So really good work with that. And I encourage folks out there to pick up a copy.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you giving a nice endorsement of the children's book that's located right there. So, all right, Michael, thanks again for coming on. This was a blast.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.